The cities were still there, the houses not yet bombed and in ruins, but the victims were millions of people. They had lost their fortunes, their savings. They were dazed and inflation shocked and did not understand how it had happened to them and who the foe was who had defeated them. Yet they had lost their self-assurance, their feeling that they themselves could be the masters of their own lives if only they worked hard enough. And lost, too, were the old values of morals, of ethics, of decency. That's Pearl Buck describing her perceptions of Germany in 1923. What was Germany like during the Weimar Republic, a fascinating period between World War I and World War II? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
The Weimar Republic was formed in Weimar in 1919 and overthrown by the Third Reich in 1933. Weimar was Germany's first attempt at democracy. Was it a success? Why did it collapse? What role did women play in it? And what relevance does the Weimar Republic have for us today? Joining us to explore the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazi Germany is Rudy Koschar, professor of history, German, and religious studies at the UW-Madison, and co-editor with Len Kaplan of a forthcoming book called The Weimar Moment.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe I'll start with a digression, but when I think of the Weimar Republic, I think as much of the culture of those times between the wars in Germany as I do the politics and the very deliberate effort, it seemed, to do something so different from all of the things that have been done before, whether it was film or music or conduct.
This is true. This is one of the aspects of the Weimar Republic that makes it a kind of icon of cultural modernism. There were so many areas of cultural practice and thought during this short period, really just the 1920s, which was the centerpiece of the entire republic, with new innovations in architecture, in art, in photography, in cinema, music. All of these areas were incubators of tremendous cultural innovation and cultural experimentation. There was a very concerted effort on the part of artists and others to break with old ways, to break with traditional forms, and to try something that was entirely new. They were often very successful in doing so. If you think, for example, of the way in which modernist or functionalist architecture, the Germans called it new building, how successful that was and how so many of those models migrated across national borders and internationally and are still with us today, despite the fact that we've seen postmodernist reactions to modernist architecture in the past quarter century. Nonetheless, those are models that are still with us. And we have in part the culture of the Weimar Republic to thank for that marvelous innovation.
We had, if you look at the 1920s, of course, that kind of deliberate breaking away, whether you were in London, certainly Paris or New York. But what made it different? It seemed to have a particular desperate edge to it in Germany.
It did indeed. If you look at the painting, for example, of the time period, it definitely has a very raw, a sinister, often a very violent, and as you say, a very desperate quality. I think one of the things that gave Weimar culture an edge that it didn't have in some of these other capitals of great artistic innovation was the fact that it was taking place during a political period that was fraught with violence and uncertainty. Germany had just lost the First World War. The vast majority of the population had believed they were winning. The military leaders, the politicians had all told them that the German military would prevail. They had lost nearly 2 million men, many thousands wounded during the First World War. And at the end of the war, when defeat was a total surprise and a quite traumatic shock for the majority of the population, the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, abdicated and left for Holland. And in a very revolutionary period, a period of tremendous political uncertainty, a lot of street fighting, tremendous violence. This is one of the reasons why the Constitution of the Weimar Republic was written in Weimar, which was a relatively sleepy and provincial city, not in Berlin. which was a very dangerous place and a very violent place politically right after the war. So it was that that political violence, the fact that not only in the cultural sphere but also in the political sphere, there was a tremendous experiment going on. Germany was trying to establish its first working parliamentary democracy. Before this time, it had been a monarchy. It had not even been a constitutional monarchy. It had been very authoritarian in structure. Certain democratic reforms had taken place before the war. A degree of parliamentarization had taken place. But in 1919, the Germans wrote a constitution, which many historians regard as certainly the most liberal in Europe at the time, perhaps the most liberal and democratic in the world.
What made it liberal? I mean, what kinds of things were part of it?
The Weimar Constitution, for example, and this was quite innovative for the time, gave everyone over the age of 21 the vote. So men and women, universal suffrage.
So a year before the United States would do that.
It was actually one of the demands that had been made in the revolutionary disturbances of late 1918, but then written into the Constitution of 1919. So that indeed was very progressive. The Weimar Constitution guaranteed as a right, not as a privilege or a benefit, but as a right, collective bargaining for trade unions. It also guaranteed rights to certain kinds of social welfare for unemployment insurance, for accident insurance, for the help of the sick and the poor. That was enormously progressive for the time. The Weimar Constitution envisioned a system of social welfare which was really a full-blown welfare state of the kind that most European states finally only created after World War II.
Well, now, of course, we have to remember that, you know, we have this great progressive tradition in Wisconsin, but essentially where did it come from? Germany.
Much of it came from Germany. Of course, we have the examples of socialist administrations in places like Milwaukee.
Yes.
Those people had been schooled in the tradition of German social democracy. Before World War I already, Germany had the largest social democratic movement, the largest socialist movement in the world, the most successful socialist party. And so that tradition lived on. One of the ironies, of course, of German history is that these social welfare measures that were now written into the Constitution had actually originated under the auspices of a very conservative authoritarian government under Bismarck. Who had been the chancellor of Germany at its founding in 1871 and who had implemented certain social welfare programs to steal a march, really, on the socialist movement. He wasn't successful. The socialist movement already before World War I in Germany had about one-third of all the delegates in the national parliament, the Reichstag. Bismarck's attempt to forestall further advances by the socialist movement were completely unsuccessful. Nonetheless, he had helped to begin a very strong program of social welfare policies that were then continued during the Weimar Republic, strengthened. And as I say, the Weimar Constitution envisioned a really full-blown welfare state.
A state with a lot of democratic participation.
A democratic state. The Social Democrats were definitely the dominant political party at the beginning of the Weimar Republic. They, in coalition with sort of left-leaning liberals within what became the German Democratic Party, as well as the Catholic Center Party, which had a strong liberal reformist wing within it. They grouped together under what was called the Weimar Coalition and received 75% of the vote in the first national elections to the Reichstag in 1919. The Social Democrats, as well as their allies, were committed to making Germany work as a democracy. Even though the Social Democrats rhetorically were committed to socialist revolution, nonetheless, they thought that the path towards social justice, towards social equality, led straight through democracy. And the only way in which you could improve the lot of not only the working man, but German society as a whole, was through democratic means.
And how stratified was Germany in terms of the class system at this point? You know, and if you think about in England where there's the House of Lords still and the House of Commons and so on, you know, just in terms of who has the money, who has the power in society.
Germany at this time was still very stratified. It had a very well-defined working class that was usually associated, as I said, with the Social Democratic movement. Probably before World War I, nearly 50% of the adult working population could be classified as manual laborers working in manufacturing. But it also had a very large agricultural segment. Perhaps a quarter of the population still derived their income from agricultural activity. And there was a great separation between the working class, which was urban, manufacturing, largely socialist, and the agricultural sector, which was much more conservative, often very anti-urban, sometimes very anti-modern. And within the agricultural sector, of course, the leading class, the equivalent of nobility in England, was the Junker class, the great land-holding class. They were concentrated in the east, in Prussia. They owned very large estates, which they farmed and which they made a tremendous amount of money off of, often
migrant workers,
bringing in Polish migrant workers before the First World War. And many of those Polish workers would go on and experience a degree of generational mobility and often joined the working class.
And what kind of leadership did this, I'll call it a loose-knit coalition of voters, select in the Weimar Republic?
The Weimar coalition selected an old-line social democrat, a person who had been a trade union leader, the first president of the republic, who was elected to a 7-year term. His name was Friedrich Ebert. Ebert was as committed to democracy as the entire Social Democratic Party was, but he was also a very cautious man. He was a man that wanted to make democracy work, but he also wanted to avoid any kind of revolutionary disturbances, of which there were many in the first years of the Weimar Republic. So Friedrich Ebert was a very responsible man, a very balanced man, who always supported a degree of moderation in his politics, but who also made a fateful mistake, and that was to rely on the military. The military, which was still very much dominated by that agricultural class, the Junkers that I had just talked about, or their allies among the more conservative parts of the German population. And so Friedrich Ebert relied really on his political enemy, on very conservative and traditional and anti-democratic forces to stabilize a democratic republic. And in that decision, of course, all sorts of very important contradictions and paradoxes would take place that would finally result in the failure of the republic.
When I was 10 or so, I came by a piece of German money from that period, from probably about 1925, very attractive, 10 billion marks or something like that, worth 10 cents or something. Inflation, I gather, was worse in Germany than almost any place else at this time.
Well, that's correct. If that coin was as worthless as you as you say it was, it probably dated from the period before November 1923. Thereafter, Germany introduced a new currency, a new mark, and that stabilized the economic situation. Before that time period, however, Germany had experienced a degree of hyperinflation that no one in the Western world had ever seen up until that point. The roots of the problem lie in the way in which the war was financed. Germany floated war loans, war bonds, which they felt could be repaid once they were victorious over their enemies, and they could basically use the resources of the occupied countries to pay off their war debt. That didn't take place. It started in an inflationary spiral that became really serious in the early 1920s and then reached its height in 1922 and 1923.
You see these accounts of people taking wheelbarrows full of money to buy bread.
That's an iconic photograph of the time, and it's absolutely true. People would be paid in the morning, and they often had to make two or sometimes three trips to the stores in the course of the day because bread, milk, all the essentials would be constantly going up in price. At the end of that period, by late November of 1923, it took 4.2 trillion marks to buy one American dollar. So this is quite extraordinary.
And why couldn't the leadership at this point in the Weimar Republic, why couldn't they do something about it? It seems as if it's something that just is way out of control.
Well, Part of it was actually an effort that was intentional on the part of the Weimar leadership. They were reacting to the French occupation of parts of Western Germany, the Ruhr industrial district, and they mobilized the German population, German workers, German office workers, German industrialists. They mobilized them to undertake a program of passive resistance against French occupation. The French goal was to try to secure the reparations that they felt the Germans were dragging their feet in delivering. And so they were going to occupy factories and other areas to try to take those reparations forcefully. Passive resistance on the part of the German government had to be paid for. Basically, they were telling people, don't go to work, don't go to the office, close up. Anytime that the French show up at a factory, you close it down. How are those people going to live? Well, the German government was going to pay their way. And in order to pay their way, they were going to have to print very large amounts of money. And so a tremendous amount of money went into circulation. And this added to the inflation and really transformed it into a hyperinflation, which was disastrous for the vast majority of the population.
And we have voices, I imagine, probably not all that subtle, already blaming some of the problems on the French.
Blaming the problems on the French, blaming the problems on the English and the Americans. This is already starting at the very end of the war in 1918, and it continues. Placing blame, however, also on internal enemies. Socialists.
Communists.
Communists.
Jews.
Jews. Dissident Christians, of which there were a tiny minority in this time period, but they were there as well. And this was an extremely tense political moment, 1922-1923. And in it, we already see the outlines of what would happen at the end of the Republic when, again, the process of naming enemies and identifying enemies would become not only quite explicit, but it would become quite violent.
And do you have people becoming nostalgic about a time when there was a monarch?
Many did. This is one of the reasons why in 1925, Friedrich Ebert had died, and it was time to elect a new president of the Weimar Republic. The person who was elected was Paul von Hindenburg, a member of that Junker agricultural class, a man who was entering his 80s at the time, a man who many, many Germans considered to be a war hero. Paul von Hindenburg was well past his time. He was not merely anti-democratic, but his heart was probably with Wilhelm I. So before even Wilhelm II, in other words, his political loyalties, his political worldview probably went back to the time of Bismarck, the 1870s and the 1880s, rather than the 1920s. Now, Paul von Hindenburg appealed to many German voters, partly for those reasons of nostalgia. He seemed reassuring. He seemed to be a force of stability. He had a kind of grandfatherly aura about him and a military bearing, which still had a great deal of legitimacy in Germany, even though the military came back as a defeated force. Even though the left in particular was very critical of the military, nonetheless, the broad majority of the population still very much respected military leaders. And so von Hindenburg was useful in all those regards and certainly to that part of the population that was backward-looking and that wished for stability and the notional security that the past held.
Did von Hindenburg have ideas of his own or did he have handlers?
He had handlers, and this is one of the great problems. At the end of the Weimar Republic, Paul von Hindenburg had slipped ever more down the road to senility. And he was really being manipulated by political intrigues, by political infighting within his own inner circle, by other members of the Junker class, and so forth. At the end of the Weimar Republic, Paul von Hindenburg was not making decisions on his own any longer.
We're going to talk about Adolf Hitler and what he was doing during the Weimar Republic when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Rudy Koshar, and we are talking about the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazi Germany. So Adolf Hitler is growing up during this time period. He's coming into his own. What does he think about the Weimar Republic, and what is the role that he's beginning to play?
Adolf Hitler was born in 1889. He served in World War I. He said he was fond of saying that his first real home, the first place where he felt emotionally secure and whole, was in the military. He spent 4 years in the military and actually fought rather well, reached the level of corporal. He was from a lower middle class Austrian background. He was not a particularly good student. He had actually, before World War I, been sort of a street person, a kind of on-again, off-again artist. He lived in flop houses in Vienna and Munich before going into the military. He came back from the war without many prospects at all. He had no particular plans. He had already been denied admission to the famous Art Institute in Vienna twice. He still considered himself to have a certain artistic sensibility, but he really had no plans. He found a job with German military intelligence for a short time in Munich. Now, Munich was a very interesting place. This is where politics was made, in the smoky beer halls of the city. This was a city that was very rich in art and culture, but also had a very contentious political atmosphere in the beginning of the Republic. Hitler discovered a political party that was really nothing to speak about at the time at all. It was more a debating club than it was a party. It did not contest elections. It was called the German Workers' Party. Hitler saw possibility in it, at least an employment possibility, and he joined the party and quickly rose within its ranks. It was quite small, a rather disparate grouping. They were more interested in preventing cheap Czech labor from coming across the border and competing with German laborers than they were in any broader political themes.
At what point did Schicklgruber become Hitler? Is he already Hitler? Are you using that trademark name by now?
Oh, yes. The family had changed the name already already before World War I. So the genealogy of the Hitler family was very unclear. The records there were great gaps in the records at the local level in Austria at the time. There was some talk that there was Jewish heritage in Hitler's background, and Hitler actually, when he became more powerful, actually employed an army of lawyers and researchers to try to get to the bottom of these rumors, which were of course very embarrassing to him, and which his leftist opponents often brought up when there was still freedom of speech during the Republic. Nothing was ever found. So Hitler has carried that name, that last name, for his entire life. And by the early period of the Republic, by 1919, 1920, 1921, Hitler has joined the German Workers' Party, and he has changed the name to the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And he brings in the two additional names because he later writes in his political autobiography, Mein Struggle or Mein Kampf, that the two great movements of the 19th century were nationalism and socialism. No party, he said, had brought them together. No party had created a kind of hybrid of those two movements. And that was going to be his goal. So he is very much a political newcomer in the early years of the Weimar Republic. He is very much of an innovator, partly because he has to be. A person who is very much on the outside looking in will try just about anything to work his way into the inner circle. And his early years in the Republic then are years of education for him. He begins to understand what the political situation is about. He undertakes a coup attempt in 1923. This is the famous beer hall putsch. The German word for putsch is coup. He undertakes that in 1923, thinking that he has the support of conservative military leaders and conservative politicians in the Bavarian state government.
To actually take over the entire German government.
Well, to take over the Bavarian government first from Munich and then lead a kind of Mussolini-style march, not on Rome, which took place in 1922, but a march on Berlin.
And what would he have said were his grievances or his reasons for justifying such a thing?
Well, his grievances were certainly the political instability of the time. His grievances were that the socialist and communist left had become far too powerful. The German Communist Party was founded in 1919. It became the most successful communist party in the world outside of the Bolshevik Party and the Soviet Union.
Well, he had Karl Marx as a legacy.
Exactly. All. And he had a strong the German communists had a strong tradition of revolutionary discourse and revolutionary practice within the Social Democratic Party before World War I. Those more revolutionary elements broke away, and they ended up joining the German Communist Party. Hitler was appalled at the strength of social democracy. He was appalled at the strength of the communist movement. He was also an anti-Semite, and that was clear from the very beginning. He was like many of the Austrian and German lower middle class insofar that they had grown up with anti-Semitic rhetoric, a racist rhetoric that had identified Jews as the other, as non-German, as alien, as urban, cosmopolitan, more well-to-do, influential in journalism, dominating the law schools and the medical schools and so forth.
The banks.
The banks. Hitler had drank of all of this poisonous rhetoric before World War I, and he came into the Weimar Republic as anti-Semitic, if not more so than he had been before World War I. So that was a very important part of his platform from the very beginning. The ideological program of the Nazi Party stated quite explicitly that Jews could never be Germans because they are of a different blood. On the other hand, he also had to be very careful about how he used that anti-Semitic rhetoric because it didn't work with all German populations. This is another element that he learned with time. One thing he did learn, though, in 1923, as he's working through these grievances, as he's trying to make a political name for himself, one thing he did learn is that a forcible coup against the German state was not going to work. The Weimar Republic, even though it was at times very unstable, even though at times it was very uncertain about its political future, nonetheless, by 1922 and 1923, it had managed to stabilize itself to such a degree that a violent attempt was simply not going to work.
And Hitler goes to jail.
Hitler goes to jail. He serves a very short sentence. Like most rightist rabble-rousers, and there were many of them in Germany, they were assassins, they were terrorists. They were also rabble-rousers, such as Hitler. And because of the fact that the German judiciary system was still dominated by old-line conservatives from the pre-World War I period, individuals who were very often monarchists would still have preferred to see the Kaiser Wilhelm II return to Germany. And they treated the right much more favorably than they did the socialist and the communist left. And so people like Hitler would get very light sentences. He had a very comfortable prison sentence in Landsberg, which is in Bavaria.
Gave him time to write that book.
It gave him time to write the book. He had access to research materials. He had visitors. He had a very comfortable time. It was more like a sabbatical leave from politics than it was a real prison sentence.
What did he say in the book, Mein Kampf?
In the book, he said that Germany had been weakened by all of the internal enemies that I've talked about. He said that the German working class had been misled by the socialist movement. He said that they needed to be brought back into the national community. This is one of the reasons why he wanted to talk about a marriage between nationalism and socialism. He said that Jews were definitely Germany's misfortune. He said that during World War I, perhaps we would have fewer problems today had we gassed several thousand Jews or several hundred Jews. I don't remember the exact wording. He said some very vicious and threatening things, and not only about Jews, but as I say, about the political left as well. His rhetoric in Mein Kampf was extremely anti-Western. It was often extremely critical of capitalism, of the present economic system. He often said very favorable things about small business. It was really a mixture of various kinds of hatreds and enthusiasms. It was not systematic at all. He had done some reading. He had read in philosophy. He had read history. He didn't necessarily bring them together in the most felicitous manner. In fact, the prose is rather dense and off-putting. But nonetheless, there was a certain ambience about the writing, a certain force, a certain urgency, a certain apocalyptic tone, you could say, to certain sections of the book that seemed to strike a chord. It certainly reflected a certain moment in German history. And even though probably not many Germans had read it at any time during the 1920s, by the 1930s, of course, it was a different story, even though, of course, historians doubt how many people really read it from cover to cover even then.
Coffee table book.
Yes.
And what did he think of the monarchy, and how did he bring Germany's past into his discussion of the future? Well,
this is an interesting question because it highlights the difference between the German old right and the new right. The monarchy was the old right. The monarchy's heart was in the right place. They loved Germany. They were patriotic. They wanted to enhance Germany's prestige internationally. They wanted colonies and so forth. But they didn't quite know how to go about that. We live in an era of mass politics. Hitler realized this. And in an era of mass politics, you do what the Social Democratic Party did before World War I. You do what the Catholic Center Party did before World War I. That is, they went out and they mobilized voters. They appealed through nationalism more emotionally than the old right had. They worked very hard at developing a party infrastructure that, as we say, could get out the vote. They worked at organizing the party in a very hierarchical manner down to the grassroots level. They used, Hitler said, the new right should use the most modern propaganda techniques, use advertising, use the radio, which of course Hitler became a master at later on, use colorful posters and so forth. The difference then between the old right and the new right, between the world of the Kaiser and the monarchy and what was going on in the 1920s was a matter of technique, but it was also a matter of tone, and it was a matter of radicality. The old right, the monarch, didn't go about its job as energetically as it should in building the German nation. Now that Germany has passed through World War I, Hitler had said, we've learned some new things. And so we must go after our enemies more energetically and more radically than we did before World War I. We know who those enemies are. And we must go against them with the most modern techniques. And above all, we must appeal to people at their emotional core. We must really make German nationalism something that people quite literally live with in the fabric of their everyday lives. The nation was still too distant for the old right. Hitler wanted to bring it into people's homes. He wanted to bring it into the factories. He really wanted to bring it into their hearts and minds.
National socialism, in order to really get inroads into the Weimar government, was it a matter of representation? In other words, the National Socialist Party gets a certain number of seats in the Reichstag, as do would other factions, and then the more seats you have, obviously, the more power you have over the overall government.
Correct. The Weimar Republic, voting in the Weimar Republic, was constructed according to a system of proportional representation. That was one of its ultra-democratic elements. That was something that was written into the Constitution, and it was lauded at the beginning of the Republic as a great advance over what Germany had had before. The problem with proportional representation is that you only needed 60,000 votes nationally to send a delegate to the Reichstag. And that, of course, led to a situation, especially in the middle of the Republic, where political parties, splinter parties, special interest groups proliferated, all with their own special interests, all sending delegates not only to the national parliament, but this was taking place also in the state parliaments and at the municipal level as well. And this gave minor political parties a voice. There's no doubt about that. And in that regard, as I say, it was a very democratic system. But it also created a degree of instability. It made it difficult for parties to be large, integrative mass parties where they could bring together various interests in what we would call a big tent.
Kind of a focus, you mean.
Exactly. And so the party political spectrum became very fragmented, and this was another criticism that Hitler would then make in the late 1920s and the early 1930s. This fragmentation was a mark of democracy's instability. The National Socialist Party stood for order. It stood for authority. It stood for bringing all those fragments back together in a unified national and racist entity.
And what role are women playing at this point? You mentioned that they were part of the Constitution. They did have the vote. Are they still playing an active role? And what did Hitler think about that?
Well, they are playing an active role. It is still very much a man's world, but women do have the vote. And voting participation in the Weimar Republic is very high. In national elections, 80 to 90% in some cases of the German electorate are voting. They knew what democracy looked like.
That's a lot better than here.
In that regard, much better than here. So this is an active, involved population, and women are part of that. Women, generally during the Weimar Republic, voted more for either the Conservative Party or, if they were Catholics, for the Catholic Center. They tended to be, rather moderate, rather centrist, or rather conservative in their voting. Hitler, though, did manage to appeal to them. If you look at the propaganda films of the time, there's the famous film that was done of the 1934 Party Congress in Nuremberg by Leni Riefenstahl.
Triumph of the Will.
The Triumph of the Will, the famous director. Women play a very prominent role there, adoring Hitler, small children dressed in traditional peasant costumes, bringing him presents and bouquets, older women expressing their adoration through their faces, through clapping, through giving the Hitler salute, and so forth. The Nazi Party does try to appeal to women. It does try to mobilize them at the voting booth. Hitler himself has extremely traditional and very backward attitudes towards women. Families where both the husband and the wife work, of course, do not fit his idea of the traditional family structure. He feels that really women do belong in the home. The Germans have this this expression, women are associated with children, church, and kitchen. And this certainly was Hitler's idea. And because of the fact also that he wanted to create a healthy racist community, he wanted to increase the German population, just as he would later try to increase its territory, create living space, Lebensraum. He wanted to increase the birth rate. Germany had the lowest birth rate in Europe after World War I. And so even though Hitler, in many of his public speeches, argued that German population density was too high, Germany needed to expand, it needed to regain territory it had lost as a result of World War I, Hitler nonetheless also argued that Germany is in danger of dying out. They have enemies on all sides. They have enemies within. A healthy racial community needs women to produce more Germans.
We're going to find out what the tipping point is where Hitler overcomes the Weimar Republic when we return in a moment. This is the University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Rudy Koschar, who is filling us in about Weimar Germany and how that republic gave way to the rise of Adolf Hitler. We found out that this is a very pluralistic effort at a democratic government between the two world wars, and that actually Hitler was able to take advantage of that, I gather, by gaining more and more seats in the Reichstag.
That's correct. The Weimar Republic was a political school for Adolf Hitler. He learned through democratic techniques and democratic practices how to mobilize a large mass movement. He realized that bullets, which he had tried in 1923, wouldn't work. Ballots had to work in order to bring him to power. He was, of course, not a committed Democrat. He wanted to use democratic means to destroy a working democracy. And he did so. In the mid-1920s, after his coup attempt, the party had pretty much splintered and fragmented. It wasn't clear at all that Adolf Hitler was going to return to any kind of political success. But in the late 1920s, there was an agricultural crisis. And then, of course, in 1929, the Great World Depression begins. It is a great disaster for Germany. Almost a third of the working population is out of work by 1932. The political parties are at a stalemate, and Adolf Hitler manages to exploit that situation. In the National Reichstag elections of September 1930, he gains over 18% of the vote. This is a multi-party system, so that's a quite substantial share. He's not yet as big as the Social Democratic Party at that time, but he has quite literally come out of nowhere. So this meteoric rise is something that everyone pays attention to, especially the old right. The old right, lodged in the conservative parties with many supporters in industry, with many supporters in the military. Many of the advisors around Paul von Hindenburg, the president of the republic, would belong to that old right. They recognize what's going on. This is a form of nationalism that they're not acquainted with. This is a new, more emotional, more mass-based nationalism. And they resolve to try to exploit it for their own means. What is their goal? Their goal really is to either weaken the democracy to such a great degree that they can replace it with a more authoritarian system, or to remove the republic altogether. They think that they can use Hitler to do this. They think they can use Hitler's mass movement as a kind of battering ram. And Hitler appears to be the man for them. By the 1932 Reichstag elections, he has just short of 40% of the vote. He never gets a majority. During the free elections of the Weimar Republic. In March of 1933, there's a Reichstag election, but by this time, the Nazi Party is pretty much in the saddle. And even then, they never get a majority of German votes. Nonetheless, then Hitler exploits the political instability, the economic crisis of the late Republic, and he presents himself as a likely candidate to return stability, to destroy the left. The Communist Party has been mobilizing. The Communist Party has also gained votes. The Social Democrats are losing votes, but they are still very much a force. So Hitler appears to be a useful tool then for the conservative right. They think they can control it.
It seems such a cruel irony of history that you have Hitler coming to power out of a democratic republic.
Well, as I said, the Weimar Republic was a very open political system. It was very pluralistic. It was a multi-party system. It gave small parties a voice. And a party committed to destroying it could use its techniques. Hitler, his propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, and others advocated getting as many delegates as they could into the national parliament. Why? Well, not only, of course, to provide a voice for the Nazi Party, but also to exploit a very nice benefit that parliamentarians got insofar that they had free railway travel anywhere they wanted to go in Germany. So this was a chance for Nazi propagandists quite literally to blanket the country.
What is Hitler saying at this point about what would still be, according to the Treaty of Versailles, I believe, the illegal buildup of the German military?
The German military has been building itself up. There is a so-called Black Reichswehr. The German military has finalized several agreements with the Soviet Union to be able to train military there to actually produce armaments on the territory of the Soviet Union. Hitler, of course, agrees with much of the right that the Versailles Peace Treaty of 1919 is a diktat. This is the term that was used, a dictate towards Germany. Hitler argues it is extremely unfair. It is an insult, a humiliation for a proud nation. And, of course, he promises that if he becomes chancellor, that he will overturn the Versailles Treaty in its entirety. Now, that was partly an empty promise. Previous chancellors had already discontinued reparations payments at the height of the economic depression. Germany was no longer paying reparations to any of the Western powers. Nonetheless, it was good propaganda. And of course, Hitler was also promising that German territorial losses would be undone.
When we look at the end of the Weimar Republic in 1933, what remains? In other words, what is the legacy of that period?
Well, I think we began talking about the cultural innovation of the time period, and that certainly is one of the legacies. The Weimar culture remains an important aspect, a really foundational a part of what we understand as cultural modernism. And I might just go back and say something about the role of women in the Weimar Republic, since we talked a little bit about them from a political standpoint. We also have many examples of women who were very much cultural innovators during this time period. I think of the artist and photomontagist Hanna Höch, whose work is not particularly well known in the general public, but certainly to academic audiences and to students who take my courses. They know a little bit about Hanna Höch. There are many others that we could mention. So cultural innovation certainly is one aspect of the legacy. I think there is a part of the legacy as well is an understanding that liberal democracy has always been a very fragile thing. It's certainly not something that Germans took for granted after the experience of 1903 to 1945 and World War II. And I think that it's anyone who lives in a Western parliamentary system ought not to take it for granted. The Weimar Republic had great possibilities. There was tremendous promise in this ultra-democratic system. And I think that the Weimar Republic actually could have survived had it not come in the wake of a disastrous war, had it not been paralyzed by two very serious economic depressions that bookended the Republic.
And perhaps had it not been for a very forceful personality who was fighting it. A change in history really require, for better or worse, a great leader?
That's correct, and it failed certainly in the category of having good democratic leaders. They were too moderate. They were too conservative. Often they were too legalistic. The Social Democrats at the end of the Weimar Republic basically wanted to defend the elections and defend the law, but they were in a revolutionary situation. They were facing a person who was committed to the end of democracy. Perhaps a better understanding, a more urgent understanding of the political crisis that was at hand would have saved the Republic on the part of the Social Democrats. Hindsight, of course, is something that's rather easy to talk about. And I think also in responding to that question, we ought not to place too much emphasis on personalities. I think there is a good argument that probably the majority of the German populace in the depths of the Great Depression in 1931 and 1932 felt that the democratic system was lost. They felt that something had to replace it. And so Hitler is giving voice to tremendous doubt. And, of course, the farther right we go on the political spectrum, stronger opposition to the whole idea of a democratic system. But it is the fragility of the system and the fragility of democracy in general, I think, that is another part of the legacy.
We opened with a quotation from Pearl Buck writing about Germany, where she talked about the inflation and the problems and so on. And she mentioned lost, too, were the old values of morals, of ethics, of decency. What was she talking about there, and how did that play into the culture of Weimar?
Well, that's an interesting remark on her part. It would have been quite easy to find people of a more conservative political persuasion or devout churchgoers to make precisely that sort of observation. One of the interesting aspects of Weimar cultural innovation was that censorship went away. The nightclubs, the movies of the time period were regarded by many.
Think of the Blue Angel there, for example.
The Blue Angel, but yes. Also Cabaret,
sure.
Which we know about.
Threepenny Opera.
The dance reviews of the time, Bertolt Brecht and Threepenny Opera. Many people of a more conservative political persuasion, but also some people in the political middle, regarded much of this work as immoral. They felt it demoralized youth, and of course, youth had been the great victims of the First World War. Many households were without a male breadwinner. Brothers, fathers had lost their lives in the war or had come back psychologically traumatized. So this was a situation where people had very often felt that they had lost their moral compass. Even the Social Democrats, however, pointed to this situation. And of course, the Social Democrats had their own ideas about what constituted proper morality. It was a morality that was based in the working class. It was a morality that emphasized social justice. On the right, ideas about morality tended to emphasize hierarchy and more traditional values, church-going values, and so forth. So that idea of moral uncertainty, a degree of moral insecurity, and inability to find a real ethical center, I think many, many Germans would have expressed it, though they would have expressed it in ways unique to their own cultural experiences and their own political loyalties.
Were any of those innovations of the Weimar Republic, cultural innovations, retained? You mentioned architecture would seem to be one, but in terms of film and other visual arts and music, those seem to have pretty much gone by the wayside during the takeover in 1933 by the Nazis.
Certainly Hitler considered Weimar cultural innovation to be as immoral as the larger culture. He insisted that there were traditional art forms, a lot of peasants and green valleys.
He liked those dirndls, didn't he?
And he liked the
lederhosen.
The dirndls and the lederhosen. He insisted that there really was a traditional German art form that had to be followed. He decried modernistic artistic expression, which fragmented the human body. He thought that was sick. And so you saw a return of a very representational form of painting after 1933. I think that in the long run, the cultural forms that originated during the Weimar Republic won out, because I think many of those individuals are still quite influential, and not only in art schools, in popular culture and elsewhere.
Rudy Koshar has been our guest for this hour. We've been looking into the world known as the Weimar Republic, Germany, between 1919-1933. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.